What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to this episode of Eyewitness History. I am your host, Josh Cohen. This episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with David Tyson. David Tyson retired from the CIA's Directorate of Operations in 2020 after a 25-year career. The majority of his service was overseas. Most of his postings and deployments were in Central Asia, the Caucasus region, and South Asia. David was a member of Team Alpha, the first group of U.S. personnel inserted behind enemy lines in Afghanistan after 9/11. During that deployment, David and the team worked closely with U.S. Special Forces, along with Afghan allies. David began his intelligence career as a linguist and interpreter, achieving fluency in Russian, Uzbek, Turkmen, Turkish, and Farsi. He is the recipient of the CIA's Distinguished Intelligence Cross, the agency's highest award for valor, and the agency's Distinguished Career Intelligence Medal. Prior to working for the agency, David served in the U.S. Army, both enlisted and as an officer. We discuss a lot here. We discuss what training in the CIA is like, why he got into it, and he gives us an incredible story involving a prisoner revolt in Afghanistan and his partnership with Michael Spann, who would sadly go on to be the first U.S. casualty of the war in Afghanistan. And now I give you David Tyson. Okay, I'm here with David Tyson. David, thank you for coming on the podcast, sir.
Oh, my pleasure.
Oh, it's my pleasure and my honor as well. So I'm really excited to talk about your background, your education, your career, and your various brushes with history, David. But before we do that, could you just briefly tell our listeners who you are and what you do? Did, I should say?
Yeah. Well, among other things, I worked for the CIA for about 25 years, and I retired in 2020. And before that, I was in the military and I was in academia. I was a graduate student for many years, and I also taught for a few years at Indiana University.
Excellent. Thank you, David. I appreciate it. So getting into your background and your education, David, my understanding was that you ended up being a fluent Uzbek speaker. Did I hear that correctly?
Yes. Well, fluency obviously is relative, but at one time I spoke it pretty well. And I spent a lot of time in Uzbekistan, and that was my academic interest, not so much the language. Well, the language was part of a broader interest I had in Central Asia, the former Soviet Union, and language, culture, and basic life in Central Asia historically and in contemporary time as well.
Understood. Understood. So then winding the clock back then, David, I'd like to ask you, where were you on 9/11 and when did you hear that it happened?
Well, I was actually flying in the air. I was flying from Tashkent, Uzbekistan to London, and I was working for the agency at the time, and I was going to a conference, a work conference or a work sort of gathering to discuss our efforts to recover Stinger missiles from Afghanistan. And I landed in London, and everything had changed. It took me a while to figure out what happened. But in the process of, about an hour or so, it became clear that the United States had been attacked and the conference was canceled. And I got back on another plane and went back to Uzbekistan.
Understood. So then I probably should have asked this a minute ago, David, but what was it that led you to join the CIA?
Well, it was nothing I had ever really planned for. I had been working, I'd been teaching. And I was sort of a perpetual graduate student at Indiana University. I really enjoyed being a student, working for my PhD, and I enjoyed the life, the studies, teaching, the travel that was involved. And over time, it became clear to me, as I had a family later on, that it was going to be difficult to get a job being a professor, teaching what I wanted to teach. And long story short, I spoke to someone who had worked for the agency, and that person spoke about the agency and worked and basically recommended that I apply, and that's what I did.
Understood. And what was the training regimen like?
Well, I was initially hired as a linguist, basically reading newspapers and other open source materials in Uzbek and Turkmen and Russian and so forth, and translating those into English and scanning them for information of interest. And shortly after joining, I became aware more about the agency and what it did. I had no real understanding or knowledge of the agency before I joined it. And when I worked there, I found out there was a whole nother world that involved, you know, sort of hands-on activities with my language, going to countries, speaking to people, gathering information, and so forth. And this appealed to me a lot more. So I moved from where I was to the Directorate of Operations and began the longish period of training, on-the-job training, and formal training to become a case officer, an operations officer. And that training took about, you know, a year, year and a half.
Wow. Excellent. Thank you, David. I don't have a lot of information here. I'll have to thank our mutual friend and my former interviewee, Mike Rassan, for sending me this info. But I understand that you were on the first CIA team behind enemy lines after 9/11. Could you please tell me about that?
Sure. I mean, there's a long story there, obviously. Every story can be long. But my first assignment was working in Central Asia and in Uzbekistan and Tajikistan and so forth. And one of my main areas of sort of work was Afghanistan. And as I mentioned before, we were charged with recovering Stinger missiles from the Afghans. These missiles, these shoulder-fired anti-aircraft missiles, were given to Afghan Mujahideen fighters who had been fighting against the Soviet Union in the 1980s. And these missiles were very, and still are, very capable, very effective anti-aircraft missiles that can take down, obviously, all kinds of aircraft, include commercial airliners. And by the time I got to Central Asia in 1998, Afghanistan had Osama bin Laden there. He had relocated from Africa and was obviously causing a lot of problems. And the agency was tasked with trying to recover missiles that we had given the Afghans that had not been fired or used or destroyed. And that job, that sort of task, led me to become familiar with Afghans themselves in Afghanistan. And over time, we made several forays into Afghanistan, not only to recover Stinger missiles, but also to talk to Afghan warlords and leaders who were fighting against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, namely bin Laden. We had an interest in gathering information on Al-Qaeda and, if necessary, using that information to try to degrade him and potentially, over time, you know, perhaps capture or kill him. So, yeah, this process gave me experience in Afghanistan, knowing Afghans. And when 9/11 happened, the agency was sort of uniquely positioned to go back into Afghanistan and sort of use and leverage the knowledge and acquaintances we had with Afghans to further our now very sort of large overarching mission to attack bin Laden and destroy Al-Qaeda.
Excellent. No, thank you, David. Perhaps just for the clarity of our audience, and certainly for me, when you say degrade Osama bin Laden, what does that mean exactly?
Well, initially in the late 1990s, it was not necessarily clear what the end game would be for our efforts against Al-Qaeda. I mean, the CIA is a government agency, obviously, that takes its directives from the presidential administration and Congress and so forth. And at the time, our job was not to go in and kill bin Laden or capture him. This is in 1998. But that all came later as the information about bin Laden became clear as to what his activities were, what he had done against our embassies, for example, in Africa. Al-Qaeda bombed two U.S. embassies in Africa, and it also had other activities going on that were clearly trying to kill Americans and harm American interests. So the efforts by the CIA to degrade, I use that term just because it's sort of a fluid It started as gathering information and then ended, obviously, after 9/11 to kill or capture him and to destroy, physically destroy Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan.
Okay, understood. Thank you, David. Is it true that at one point you didn't own a pair of shoes when you were living in Uzbekistan?
Well, for a brief period of time. Yeah, I spent a lot of time in Uzbekistan before I joined the CIA. And I must say, I enjoyed almost every minute of my time in Uzbekistan as a student. And that spanned several years. I had many, many Uzbek friends, great experiences. I traveled around the country. I spent time in Turkmenistan as well, other parts of Central Asia. I was really obsessed with learning everything I could about Central Asia, its people, its culture, its history, its languages, and so forth. So I had a great time in Central Asia. I had a lot of good friends. And on one occasion early on, I took a train from Tashkent to a city in the Fergana Valley called Namangan. It was an overnight train. And I was in the general sort of train section where it's called Platzkarts. It's a German term that was used then, but it's sort of open bay, what do you call it, bunks. So you just get a bunk along with many, many other people, and you get to meet many, many people very sort of intimately, closely for a long period of time, you know, overnight on these trains. And it was very interesting. And I simply, when I went to sleep or tried to at night, I put my shoes, my sneakers, you know, American-made sneakers. And this is in 1990, I think it was, when, you know, the Soviet Union still existed. And times were tough in Central Asia. And my shoes were sort of unique in the sense that there were not Americans. There weren't many American sneakers floating around Central Asia. And obviously, someone took interest in them and stole them when I was sleeping. And in the morning, I obviously couldn't find them. And I have large feet, around size 13 or so. And I had no other shoes with me. So the conductor, they got me a couple sort of cardboard boxes. We worked it. So I had several layers of cardboard. And then eventually during the day, I got some rubber galoshes. And only after a week or two was I able to find a pair of shoes that fit me. And this is the Soviet Union again, where shoes were hard to come by, especially good ones and large ones. So I was shoeless for a short period of time, but it was no great tragedy.
Right.
It was kind of fun and interesting, you know, the only American running around, you know, and you're shoeless in these small areas, small towns and villages of Uzbekistan. It was just another way to call attention to myself, I guess.
Excellent. My understanding is you met two men that would go on to become leading Uzbek jihadists. Do I have that right? Juma Namangani and Tohur Aldash. Apologize, butchered the names there.
These were two figures that later became fighters and aligned with Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. And both of them were later killed in fighting against U.S. forces. But at the time, this is the early 1990s, there was a lot of change and accelerated change going on in Central Asia and Uzbekistan. The Soviet Union was falling apart. The countries started to, there was nationalistic tendencies. There were just people who wanted to break away from the Soviet Union. There was political activities going on. And one of the things that was happening in Uzbekistan, like Central Asia, being, you know, these are areas that had long been Muslim countries for centuries, there was a rebirth of Islamic activity. There was a revival of interest in Islam, and a large number of young people, especially, and older people, became extremely interested in Islam. It was the religion of their forefathers, and they were still Muslim, but now they had the freedom to a degree to explore Islam, and all kinds of things came about after that. And you had small communities of Muslims respond in different ways to the freedom and the effort to gather information. And some of these communities engaged in a sort of robust Islamic activities to include a sort of vigilantism against rules and laws and sort of the Soviet culture that had been there for so long. And Yoldashev and Namangani were part of this. And this is in the Namangan area, a small area, well, an area in eastern Uzbekistan. And me being the only American sort of in town, there was a lot of people interested in meeting me because I spoke Uzbek and was there and I represented, you know, the United States. And it was of great interest to many people in Uzbekistan, like the Soviet Union, to meet an American. And so these are two of the people of the many, you know, hundreds and maybe even thousands of people I met during my years, those early years in Uzbekistan for me.
What can you tell me about Kala Jangi?
Kala is sort of a fortress, or and Jang is war or battle. And so it's the fortress of war. And it's an old Afghan fort that was built, I believe, in the 1800s. And it survived. It still exists. And it was a big place where Afghan military units were housed, and the Soviet military was there, and then Taliban, and then anti-Taliban forces, and now the Taliban have it again. So it's a big fortress in the Mazar-e-Sharif area of northern Afghanistan. So physically, it's just a big, big fort made of mud and clay, about 30, 40 foot high walls. And it just houses, you know, it's sort of a barracks and a headquarters area for military forces.
Understood. And I'm curious to know, I'm just going to read this off quick. I know you were there. You were with Michael Spann, who sadly became the first U.S. casualty of the war. And it was at that point where the prisoner revolt began. Could you please tell listeners about that?
Sure. I have to plug a book here that gives a very in-depth story, and I think a fairly, well, an accurate and sort of interesting, it's well-written story. The book is called First Casualty, and it's written by an author named Toby Harnden, H-A-R-N-D-E-N. And he wrote the book, that, and it came out a couple years ago, and it tells the story of our deployment, our CIA teams. The team was called Team Alpha, our deployment to Afghanistan right after 9/11 to work with a specific Afghan warlords in northern Afghanistan to topple the Taliban, take the city of Mazar-e-Sharif, and gather intelligence on Al-Qaeda and so forth. So Mike Spann and myself, along with six other men, were part of Team Alpha. We linked up with a Green Beret operational detachment, Alpha Team, and we, together, we prosecuted the war against Taliban and Al-Qaeda, gathered intelligence, and in late November 2001, some 400 to 500 Al-Qaeda prisoners surrendered to Afghan forces and were brought to Kala Jangi, this large fortress where we were to gather their information in the form of documents and verbal information. And that was the prelude to the uprising that took place on 25 November.
Excellent. Thank you. And yeah, and then the uprising, my understanding was a number of the prisoners had hidden weapons, which they then used to start the revolt, correct?
Yes, yes, they did. These were Al-Qaeda prisoners, meaning they were all foreign fighters who had sworn allegiance to Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. And they were, some of them, it turns out, were not surrendering. And it was all part of a larger plan to continue the war and the jihad. And they secreted weapons during the process of the interviews or being brought out to an area in the fortress. The several of the prisoners used their weapons, killed the guards, got more weapons, and started this uprising that lasted about 4 days. And during the uprising, Mike Spann was killed along with a large number of our Afghan allies.
And how did you get out, David?
Well, it's written about in the book in some detail. When the uprising began, I had my pistol with me, a Browning 9mm pistol, that I had not fired throughout the deployment, and I had not fired for a number of years. And when the uprising started, I had to use my weapon in order to get to where Mike Spann was. And I think, you know, I expended all my rounds. I had 75 rounds of 9mm ammunition. I used all the rounds. I had 5 magazines. And I used my weapon as well after I got to Mike, and he had a Soviet-style Kalashnikov rifle. But the thing, there's two things that are, to me, notable about that for myself, the uprising, was number one, Mike's death. Mike was a teammate and a friend and a great American who had a family, a wife and children. And he was our, as noted, our first casualty in the war in Afghanistan. And he's not only a symbol of what America is and should be, but he's also a person who was a father, a son, a brother, and a husband, and a friend to many, many people. So that's a story unto itself. And Mike's legacy continues today. And the second thing for me that's notable about that day, aside from other casualties among great friends we had among the Afghans, was my own experiences that involved me basically being sort of transported into a new realm, if you will, where I lost my sense of hearing. Things went into slow motion, tunnel vision. I had tunnel vision as I sort of fought my way out of the portion of the fort where all the prisoners were. And it was just a very, very strange and ultimately fascinating experience mentally and in terms of my own, you know, physical and mental state, that I was in this strange place of slow motion and thoughts were just bombarding me that were odd and somewhat, well, it's something I had not experienced before or since. Yeah, that's part of that day that I won't forget, that, you know, it happened over 20 years ago, but it remains sort of the central day in my own life in terms of, in many ways.
Wow, that's an incredible story, David. Thank you. One question I want to ask, this might be an odd one, and you may have actually already answered it, but let me go ahead and ask it. What is your mindset? And I would say, what sort of mental decisions do you have to make when you know you're about to go into a firefight?
Well, that day, unlike other days, well, and like other days, no one was expecting to go into a firefight. Mike and I and the other Afghans we were with had no plans to engage the enemy that day. But I will say, I'd like to just back up a little bit and speak about the deployment of our team to Afghanistan and how that sort of, you know, prepared us and myself for 25 November. We flew into Afghanistan in 2 Black Hawk helicopters, you know, a couple months before, and we were working with our Afghan allies, and on a daily basis, we were sometimes gradually and sometimes very quickly, you know, we came to terms with the fact that we were in a whole different situation in the sense that we were in combat amongst Afghans fighting other Afghans and Al-Qaeda personnel. The U.S. military presence was small. Our presence was small. We had a, as I said, a team of Green Berets with us and our own team consisting of 8 men. And many days and many nights we spent in very small groups moving around on horseback to other areas to meet other commanders fighting the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, making sort of agreements with them, supplying them with weapons and so forth, doing airdrops and so forth, and gathering intelligence. And during those weeks, you know, we became sort of accustomed to what was happening on the ground, and something most of us had never experienced before. Again, the sort of the day in and day out tensions and apprehensions and anxieties regarding combat and threat that was there against us. And during that process, you start to you know, for the lack of a better word, you gain sort of, you get accustomed to your surroundings, your environment, and you acquire sort of a skill set, a mental skill set that helps you in your decision making and in your actions. And again, I'm sort of going, and I'm not really answering your question here, but I must say that it was a process, a daily process. Again, none of us had been in situations like this before, whereby our leadership, I mean, our team leader, his name was JR, and our assistant team leader, his name was Alex, were making all these decisions for us and regarding our team's activities. And there was a certain risk calculus that was being done every single day, multiple times, as to what we should and should not be doing in order to succeed or carry out our mission and not get killed and not have this deployment turn into some disaster because of something we did or did not do. And that risk calculus fell upon the team leadership, again, JR and Alex, and they navigated this masterfully throughout. And I guess to make a longer story short, that being exposed to all these things, these decisions, and to our environment, to our Afghan allies, to our enemies, it enabled us and enabled me, I think, very critically, me sort of acquire all these sort of intangible skills and understandings that accompanied me to that day on 25 November when I was forced to basically fight for my life and use my weapons and so forth in very close quarters combat with the enemy.
Wow. Wonderful. Thank you, David. As a result, you were awarded the Distinguished Intelligence Cross, which, if my information was correct, it's the highest decoration awarded by the CIA. Now, I'd like to ask you, David, how did you find out that you had earned it, and what was that experience like getting it?
You know, to tell you, I can't recall when I was informed about the award, and that's, you're making me think right now, and I can't remember. I was still at my post in Uzbekistan. You know, after Mike's death and after our deployment, I just went back to Uzbekistan where I lived with my family. And I was informed, I'm sure I was informed somehow, either by, probably my boss told me about it. And I went back to our headquarters, and I believe it was in 2002, to be given the award along with many, many other people who were involved in my deployment and in other deployments. There was, I know for a fact, I was one of two recipients of that award that day. So it's, frankly, it's all a blur now. I had a period of time after 25 November 2001 where I, you know, now I don't remember much of it. And I guess that's because of all kinds of reasons, old age and also just sort of the effects of those days and especially that day and the days that followed 25, 26, 27, 28 November were very, very difficult for me mentally. Especially going, trying to go back to Palaijangi and recover Mike's body and conduct assaults with the Afghans to get Mike's body against the Al-Qaeda forces that remained. You know, these were, I'll use the word traumatic experiences for me. And I think as a result, I don't remember a whole lot in the days that followed, or I don't remember now. And the award was obviously a very nice gesture, and it's very, very meaningful, but I don't necessarily feel that qualified to be a recipient. I just did what I did. You know, it was a very dramatic time, very dramatic events, but I simply was doing things on automatic pilot, and I don't think there was a whole lot of courage. There was a whole lot of fear involved on my part, especially in the days that followed. So the award is symbolic of greater things, obviously. I don't know how many of those things are really applicable to myself, but they certainly are applicable to what CIA officers do, what U.S. Special Operations Forces do, and to the memory of Mike Spann. So the award is a great thing. I can't say that award does not belong to me. It's in my name. But it's certainly something that belongs to a whole lot of people. And I sort of, I'm the custodian of that award in my name, but it's not really mine. It's something that the agency, many agency officers might deserve that award, especially for that period of time. So I can't say it's, again, it's very, very meaningful, but it's sort of a collective thing, if you ask me.
Right, right. I understand that. This seems like almost a silly question to ask at this point, David, but is there a particular accomplishment during your time with the agency that you're especially proud of?
Well, you know, sometimes I give talks to young agency officers. What sticks with me over the years, and now, you know, I'm an older person, retired person, you know, the adventures, the achievements, the cool stuff we did, and there was so much of that. It was a daily adventure, not only in Afghanistan, but in many, many places, other places that I worked. The thing that sticks with me are the people I met and befriended, got to know, to include many agency officers. The agency is full of kick-ass people, and I mean that in a very positive way. People who are very intelligent, very skilled, and unique. And meeting them, getting to know them, and working with them over, you know, more than two decades was just a great experience. The quality of these people is incredible, and they are very interesting people for the most part. In many cases, very, in a way, fascinating, curious people with a variety of skill sets. Secondly, what I remember, and I consider this achievement an achievement as well, is getting to know the foreigners that I dealt with over those years as well. Specifically, in this case, people in Uzbekistan and people in Central Asia and people in Afghanistan. During the deployment, we lost many Afghans. We had intense, close, but short-term relationships with them during the deployment. I mean, we were just there for a couple months, and we smashed so many things into a short period of time, meeting so many great people, and some of them were lost during our deployment and subsequent to it. And those people remain in my memory, and they certainly, again, the CIA officers, U.S. military guys, the Afghans, the Uzbeks, and all these other people that I got to meet over my career, they enriched my life so much that it's hard to quantify it, to put it into words, to convey it and so forth. But man, I can just sit here and just think about person after person and just, you know, smile and sometimes cry. And these are not all great people, you know, unfortunately. At the agency, we're very rarely asked to do easy things. We're always asked to do hard things and things that nobody else want to do and nobody else can do. And sort of we're always given the worst case scenarios and we're trying to figure out what's the best of the worst case scenario or what's the least worst. And so not all the people we meet during our careers are good in terms of the foreigners we meet, but many of them are great people. They certainly are always interesting people. And that's what sticks with me and allows me sort of, again, to just smile. And when I think about these people and these events and activities we were part of.
Yeah, that's wonderful, David. Thank you. I just have a couple questions left, David, if that's okay. What is Badger 6?
Badger 6 is a charity organization, a nonprofit that was started in 2021 by myself, Shannon Spann, the widow of Mike Spann, Justin Sapp, a member of our team, Team Alpha, Mark Nooch, the commanding officer of the ODA 595 Green Beret team that was with us, and Dr. Azim, who's a Afghan-American who was born and raised in northern Afghanistan. We created this charity to assist the Afghan commanders, the cavalry commanders whom we rode with during our deployment, who fought with us, fought beside us, and who some of these men died, were killed in action. And our charity aims to support monetarily and help the surviving Afghans that were with us, all of whom we know by name, by, you know, we personally know we're trying to get these men and their families to the United States and resettled. We succeeded with a couple of families, but we have many families left. And the situation in Afghanistan, as you know, is disastrous, a total disaster. Half the population has no life whatsoever because they're women. They have no future. And the other half of the population, the men of Afghanistan, have little to live for and look forward to either. So it's a terrible, terrible situation. And those who fought with us, the United States, and who are still in Afghanistan are suffering more than their others and are suffering more than ever. And it's our duty as individuals, and I believe as a country, to assist these Afghans and support them in any way possible. And Badger6.org is set up to do that. And that's what we're working on currently. It takes a great deal of time and effort on our part, but it's all well spent.
Absolutely, David. Thank you. And yeah, just to sharpen that, anyone interested in finding out more can go to Badger6.org and get connected there. Excellent. David Tyson, thank you so much for sitting down with me and chatting. This was a real honor. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.